The History of the Old Brick Church podcast is brought to you by St. Luke's Historic Church and Museum, located in Smithfield, Virginia. As a museum and historic site, St. Luke's focuses on the development of religious freedom and the early American religious experience. This program was supported by a grant from Virginia Humanities.
And welcome, everyone, to another episode of History from the Old Brick Church. I'm your host, John Erickson. Today, we are so pleased to have with us Dr. Eric Mazur. Dr. Mazur is the Gloria and David Furman Professor of Judaic Studies and Professor of Religious Studies and Religion, Law, and Politics Fellow at the Robert Nussbaum Center, formerly the Center for the Study of Religious Freedom, all at Virginia Wesleyan University in Virginia Beach. Dr. Mazur, it's great to have you with us. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
So while you're not technically in the history department, certainly your area of expertise requires a vast knowledge of history. So my question for every one of our guests has been, what for you inspired you to delve into the topic of history and what still inspires you to?
First, the study of the academic study of religion, as it's done in the United States, is more of a topic than a discipline. And so we steal disciplines from, so we're trained as historians or sociologists. So I'm trained in part as a historian of religion in America. I suppose there are people in history departments that might not see me as a historian. But thankfully, my colleagues in the history department at Virginia Wesleyan see me as a historian or as capable of doing history. My interest in this topic, religious liberty, I think comes from my youth, growing up quite often as the only Jewish kid in school, in public schools in Newport News, Virginia, where throughout the year there might be questions or accusations. Christ killer, that kind of thing from other kids. But particularly around Christmas, there would be either attempts to bring in Hanukkah or, which, you know, is its own set of problems. Or one year in particular, I was sent, the only kid in the school, sent to the library, while the rest of the school, including the librarian, went to a Christmas assembly where they sang Christmas songs. I'm sure some of them were, theological. Most of them were just, about Santa or the weather,
Jingle bells.
But those experiences, I think, had an instrumental part in me thinking about the issue of religious liberty. When I was an undergrad at the University of Virginia, I was fortunate enough to take a course with William Miller, who I don't know if you're familiar with him, but a public intellectual, I think, is probably one of the ways to describe him. And his course was on religious liberty. He had recently written a book called First Liberty, and he was in the communications department, but he focused on religious freedom as a communication issue, right? The documents of religious liberty. And that I think really got me hooked. And so I continued to work in that area with other faculty members. And it's something that just grabbed my interest. And so it became a sort of a life's pursuit. Now, my training broadly is in religion and American culture. So I'm trained really from the Native Americans to the present. I do a lot of work in religion and popular culture, religion and film, religion and television, and also Judaism in America. But my first love was always religious liberty. It was the subject of my dissertation, my first book, a number of publications.
We're going to return to the subject of the Jewish American experience, especially in the 19th century. But I want to start off. We've been working from the colonial period on up through the early American Republic. And so the conversation today with you is about kind of the post constitutional period through the 19th and even into the 20th centuries and challenges to religious liberty. But I wanted to start off because a lot of the misnomers about the founding of our republic, and just for those who are listening, we're recording this just 2 days before Thanksgiving. So we always get this theme around the Thanksgiving time that, you know, North American continent was this bastion for religious freedom. A kernel of truth in that some Protestant Christians had some freedom compared to what they had back in England, but certainly not true for other religious groups. And right on the eve of the Constitution, as the states are compiling their state constitutions, 9 of the 13 of the original states have these religious clauses that prevent really full citizenship to anybody other than Protestant Christians who espouse Jesus as Lord. So what do you think was in the minds of these people who are the same people that are going to ratify the Constitution and eventually the Bill of Rights, which includes anti-establishment? What was the fears or thoughts about that?
Well, I think the states were much more homogeneous than we think of today. And so there often was an established church or a legacy of an established church or a legacy of a dominant church, even if it wasn't established. And so the laws were just a continuation. The early colonial laws were just replicated in large part, I think, once the colonies are considering statehood. I think also that there was a great deal of suspicion among the Protestants themselves. With my students, I remind them that if you think about competition or rivalries, rivalries are between people who are recognized as rivals. If you don't recognize someone as a rival, then you don't have a rivalry with them. So Jews were not seen as rivals. Catholics were not seen as rivals except in the most extreme way, right? Not rivals, more like existential terror. Women were not considered rivals. African Americans were not considered rivals. Native Americans were not considered rivals. There were, if any, Muslims. They were enslaved for the most part. There were no Hindus or no Buddhists. So all you really had were different forms of Protestants. Some who broke their egg from the top and some who broke their egg from the bottom. And that was really the cause of anxiety, whether they were descended from the Church of England or separatist. And so I think the First Amendment, which specifically refers to Congress, was an attempt to indicate to the different Protestant groups that might be down in different states that at least in the federal government would not pick sides. And that, in association with Article 6, which prohibited religious tests, meant that Congregationalists wouldn't have to worry about Episcopalians. Episcopalians wouldn't have to worry about Congregationalists. And, you know, there wasn't much deviation. Obviously, Unitarians were a significant movement in the Northeast. Quakers were a significant presence in the Mid-Atlantic. Pretty much it was your either established Protestants or your dissenting Protestants. And that's really what people were focused on. I also use the analogy of modern construction. Right? I'm sitting here in this workspace and I see stairs that lead up there. It's not that we thought, oh, well, if somebody's in a wheelchair, we don't care. It's that when the stairs were put in, we didn't think about people in wheelchairs, but now we do. And not just people in wheelchairs, but people with other physical challenges who might not be able to get upstairs. So our consciousness has expanded. Yes. I think the people in the 1770s, 80s, 90s were just not thinking. They weren't actively excluding. They just didn't register in their consciousness. And so there was no need to include them or to worry about their inclusion.
So certainly even to make a law that talks about Protestants generically was actually for them kind of a big leap, because then it would have been talking about rivals then, right?
Sure. And that's why a lot of the states maintain these restrictions, oaths of office that require a belief in the Trinity, which would have excluded Unitarians, or a renunciation of ecclesial authority, which would have excluded Catholics, right? But that's intended for the state level because things were much more homogeneous on the state level. The federal government, the big mission of the people we identify as the founding fathers, was to get this collection of very different people together under one banner. And so you make things as vague as possible so everybody sees that their interests are represented, or at least they're not being gored, and they can join in. But on the state level, it's much more restricted.
Yeah, I suspect that Madison wanted more universal religious freedom, but yeah, you also have to get people to ratify the document. And without having to play politics there, he had to make concessions. So everything's on the federal government level rather than on the state level.
Yeah. William Miller, this professor of mine that I had as an undergrad, put it this way. He said, Roger Williams, the founder of Rhode Island and, you know, a separatist, the Baptists claim him, but Miller said he was a Baptist for like 15 minutes. But, but, you know, he's seen in that light. His argument was that the establishment of Christianity is what led to its downfall. A fairly typical Protestant position, right? When the Catholic Church is co-opted by the Roman Empire, that's when Christianity goes to hell in a handbasket.
That's okay.
And it's not redeemed again until the Protestants are able to separate Christendom, which for Williams was a bad thing. Christendom was the corruption of Christianity.
Yeah.
So for him, religious freedom was to protect religion from government. Miller argued that Jefferson took the opposite position, that religious freedom was to protect government from the rivalries of religion.
Hmm.
And he said Madison was sort of in between. He saw the good and the bad of both, and saw religious liberty as a way to balance them.
So because we have this kind of compartmentalization between the states and the federal government, there's going to be an enormous amount of what we in the 21st century, at least, would consider to be very religiously repressive laws and actions. And kind of the obvious one that I wanted to talk about was the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is popping up in the 1830s. The repression against this group is so extraordinary that even the governor of Missouri is basically giving carte blanche orders to murder anyone. How in the world, by the 1830s, when all establishment is now going out? I mean, the last one is in Massachusetts in like 1834. So at this point, how in the world can we have something like this happen in this country?
Well, first of all, the established church in Massachusetts was really a tax mechanism, right? So you had to pay taxes to a religious institution. The state provided which groups you could check off. There were a variety, but it was limited. So if you were a Satanist, forget it. Your group wasn't on the list. But, you know, the usual suspects would have been. And that's in many ways seen as the last establishment. But there are still heavy religious restrictions. The oaths of office will exist in states that had been colonies until the 1890s. States that become states after the Revolution generally mirror the First Amendment in the U.S. Constitution. But colonies that became states retained a lot of those restrictions really until the 1890s. And the Supreme Court, you know, the Supreme Court decides the issue in 1960 of an atheist justice of the peace who refuses to pledge to swear to God and is refused his commission as a justice of the peace in Maryland. It goes all the way to the Supreme Court. And in Maryland, he is found, his claims are refused because the Maryland Supreme Court says it's right there in the Constitution. The state Constitution says you have to swear this oath of office because the federal courts, and he's vindicated. Procaso v. Watkins. there's also the case also in Maryland of what's come to be called the Jew Bill, where Jews were not permitted to participate in Maryland, really until the passage of what was called the Jew Bill, which opened the franchise to Jews. This is in the 1820s and 30s.
It was really called that?
It was called the Jew Bill. It may explain why many Jews find it very uncomfortable when non-Jews use the word Jew. Because it sounds like an accusation. No non-Jew has ever used the word Jew as a compliment, I don't think. But so what's going on with the Mormons is not that out of step. But I also think there's a different issue with the Mormons, and that has to do with political power. In New York, they're hardly noticed. They don't really come to be noticed until they have a critical mass of people in their community in Ohio and Illinois and Missouri, where they threaten the local political structure. Their views on plural marriage, there's a debate about when it becomes known, but it doesn't become public until the 1850s. There are some historians who argue that it's known before then. But I really think that much of the difficulty, specifically the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, there are many different Mormon groups, but the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the difficulties they have with the federal government and with state governments really has to do with political power. If you're convinced that everyone in your group is voting a particular way and you are not their way, then you're going to see them as suspect. And I think that's one of the motivating factors. I think people become very anxious about plural marriage and also about what today we might call cult-like behavior. I'm not saying the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints engaged in cult-like behavior, but I think that was the fear of non-Mormons. Certainly given the structure of the church, which is in many ways much like the Catholic Church, right? Very hierarchical. And also given the personality of someone like Joseph Smith, there were just concerns. Fairly regularly from the time the Mormons settle in Ohio until they make their way out to the Salt Lake Basin, and even then, the Mormons are writing to the president, writing letters to the president saying, please protect us. We're being persecuted by the state. But the First Amendment says we have religious freedom. And rarely does the president actually respond. Usually it's, you know, some lower assistant secretary or something. But the response is usually, this is a state problem, not a federal problem. As a matter of fact, in the 1840s, the Supreme Court will make that ruling specifically involving funeral rituals in New Orleans and the requirement that certain clergy participate and the objection of some over which clergy participate. It goes all the way to the Supreme Court. And in the 1840s, the Supreme Court says the First Amendment has nothing to do with state or local law. It says Congress shall pass no law. This is not a congressional law. This is not our problem. And so the problems that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has in Ohio and Illinois and Missouri are a state problem. The federal government chooses not to be involved. It becomes even more interesting when the community moves out to the Salt Lake Basin. Now they're in federal property. When they get there, by the way, it's Mexican, but shortly it will become U.S. property, but it's federal, not state, right? It's territory. And so now they are clearly under federal jurisdiction. But now, by hoping to set up the state of Deseret, they are challenging the federal government. And so they become a problem for the federal government and not for any particular state. And they don't succeed in achieving the kind of freedom I think they were looking for until they publicly renounce plural marriage, but also publicly renounce the church-run political party that had governed the territory. Then Utah becomes a state, and Utah elected members of Congress and the Senate become seated without challenge. And that's in the early 1900s. So it's not just about plural marriage, and it's not just really about religion. It's about a challenge of power. Who's got the power? The state or the federal government or this group of Mormons?
So if you've got a large group of adherents to the Mormon tradition coming into your locality, they could easily become the dominant political power. And that's going to really feel like a threat.
Sure. It's, it's the challenge of democracy.
Yeah. Right?
If you're overwhelmed by people who disagree with you, then, you know, you either have to organize in better numbers or find a way to get rid of them. And that's what the states tried to do.
And their fears were not allayed when Joseph Smith tries to run for president.
Well, you know, it's interesting. He tries to run for president. You know, his attempt is only a few months long because he's eventually lynched.
Yeah.
But according to the material that I've encountered, his decision to run for president was largely because, and this is while they're still in states, right? So they're being persecuted by the states. But his decision is because the federal government will not provide any protection. So if there's nothing to be gained from either of the major political parties, Joseph Smith says, well, why shouldn't I run for president myself? And then it's quickly snuffed out when he is lynched. But the motivation, you know, why, I don't know why anyone would want to run for president. I really don't. But apparently his motivation was to get the federal government in a position where it will protect his community because it wasn't there to begin.
So maybe he had something in mind similar to the 14th Amendment that's going to change some of the federal government's view of that state versus federal.
I think it had more to do with mobilizing, federalizing local militias and physical protection rather than legal protection.
Mm-hmm.
Because in many ways, yes, the laws were generally stacked against the Mormons, but the proof is in Joseph Smith's lynching. They were physically in danger.
Yeah.
And they needed guns in their service and not in the service of the states.
So I came across a situation that I shared with you earlier that happens during the Civil War. And the Civil War is really the overarching thing, too, with the Mormons, I think, too, is because the Mormons renounced enslaving people, which I think certainly had a political issue there too, even though there might be some racial issues involved within that group, but chattel slavery was not one that they were wanting to participate in. And as we're having new states come into the Union, whether they're going to be slave or free, that's a very hot button issue. I'm sure that
absolutely
is stacked against them as well. But in the Civil War, a very kind of obscure thing happens, and it's when General Grant is in charge of the Western Theater. So we're talking about the territory between the Mississippi and the Tennessee rivers. And he's ensconced over in Vicksburg. And there's a smuggling ring going on that ironically his own father, Jesse's involved in. But there are members of the Jewish community involved in it. And rather than him seeing that as simply a bunch of rogue individuals, he sees it as a group, and they must be expelled. And General Order Number 11 is issued in December of 1862. Talk about how a Jewish person would receive that, especially people coming from Russia or other places in Eastern Europe where the laws were very repressive.
If it's okay, I'd actually like to go back to the point you made about the Mormons.
Yeah.
The Mormons did renounce slavery, but were, because of their situation, firmly supportive of states' rights. So in many ways, that put them in the camp with the Confederacy, which may be part of the reason why one aspect of the Civil War takes the federal forces all the way out to Colorado. Right? I mean, Colorado, what are they doing? Right?
Yeah, that's right.
But, you know, the federal government had to protect its western flank. And it's also why plural marriage or bigamy is not a federal offense until the southern states are out of Congress, because the southern states have blocked any declaration of bigamy being a federal offense because they wanted the Mormon support in terms of states' rights. Once there's no Southern representation or Confederate representation in Congress, you have the passage of the Morrill Act, not M-O-R-A-L, but M-O-R-R-I-L-L, a member of Congress,
okay,
who also, by the way, gave us a land-grant colleges, it's the same guy. The Morrill Act made a federal offense of plural marriage. And that becomes the federal government's opportunity to really go after the Mormon church. So, you know, the Mormons and the Confederacy, it's an interesting relationship.
Yeah.
You know, sort of, I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine. But going to General Order number 11, it occurs during the Civil War. Most of the American Jewish population at that time was of Central and Western European and Southern European descent, of German descent, really. And that doesn't change much in terms of their reaction, except in terms of some logistics. The first major wave of Jewish migration to North America were Jews who are ethnically identified within the Jewish community as Sephardi. They are Jews who are often identified with Muslim Spain and then kicked out in, you know, the 1400s by Ferdinand and Isabella. But really are Jews who, across North Africa and into the Eastern Mediterranean and Southern Mediterranean, had developed a Mediterranean orientation, but also sort of an ocean-going orientation. When they come to this country, they come by way of Holland and the, you know, Dutch colony in what is now Brazil. And they leave Brazil when it becomes Portuguese, because the Portuguese had also kicked Jews out. And they come to the Caribbean and then New York because it was Dutch. And so they could still. But the Jewish orientation, the orientation of the Sephardi was very Atlantic Rim. They were very involved on the Atlantic coast, in the Caribbean, into the Mediterranean, and by way of the Dutch, into the North Atlantic. So they stayed on the East Coast, by and large. The next major wave of Jews to come to North America were those from areas we today identify as Germany, right? It wasn't quite Germany yet, but they come to this country. They're much more familiar with a lot of the thinking, continental thinking of Europe. And so they're engaged in basic capitalism, trade, and they move into the frontier. They follow the American expansion. And that's why there are Jews in the Tennessee Valley, the Department of Tennessee, or whatever it's called, in the 1860s. Like Frankfort, Kentucky, is a heavily German town. And so there are German Jews there, which is why in Cincinnati, there's the oldest Jewish seminary in America. Mm-hmm. And most people would not think Jews, oh, well, that means Cincinnati, right? But it's all part of this desire to come from poverty in Central Europe and make it in a capitalist system in the United States. So they're traders and they spread out. And, you know, synagogues are founded in the outer reaches of beyond by Jews who are merchants. But the worldview of these Jews is not that different from the worldview of Jews who come later from Eastern Europe, what is today Russia and the Eastern Baltic countries. And that is, we exist here entirely at the whim of our host. Jews have been kicked out of countries in Europe, starting in the 1200s, you know, kicked out of England, kicked out of Spain, kicked out of France, kicked out of Portugal, kicked out of Eastern European countries. The model goes back further to the biblical period, right? The conquest of the Jews by the Babylonians and the relocation of the Jewish world from what is today Israel to the Babylonian world, which, by the way, only lasted about 50 years in terms of removal. And then the Persians overwhelmed the Babylonians and permit the Jews back to Israel. But nonetheless, in that realm, Jewish life thrives. But it waxes and wanes. And when the mood of the host turns ugly, Jews are killed or expelled. And this is a model that is replayed historically, but also built into Jewish theology. The Hebrew word is galut. Galut means exile. And Jews understand themselves physically in exile from, the Babylonian exile. But it also means exile from God, distance from God. Mm. And that distance will never be repaired until the Messianic age. And Jews, through the observance of Jewish ritual, can bring about the Messianic age by following the laws given to the Hebrews by God, Mount Sinai. But it just means that until that time, no place is really home. Politically, no one is going to accept the Jew. That's been the model for 1,800, 2,000, 2,500 years. But also theologically, we're not home until we're back in the land that God promised. Once Israel is founded as a nation, that brings challenges to Jewish theology, obviously. But the Jews felt they had a right to be in Tennessee. But I think we're not, if they knew their Jewish history and theology, we're not terribly surprised by what happened.
So, I imagine there had to be some hopefulness that because of at least the federal laws protecting some semblance of religious freedom, that maybe America could be different. And this is a kind of still a bit of a shockwave through the Jewish leadership in those communities.
I think there is a sense. And, members of the Jewish community participated in the parades after the ratification of the Constitution. You know, there was a sort of ecumenical spirit in a lot of Americans' public rituals, particularly those that certainly, that centered on patriotism. There's always a dark side, of course, but I think in the established big cities where Jews were in a significant enough number, there was a greater sense of security. But I think you're right. There's also a sense from overseas that America is the land of opportunity, economic opportunity, religious opportunity, any kind of opportunity. But I think there's also a sense that at any time, that can change. And it's why what we see with General Grant is a delegation of Jews going to Washington to try to talk to Lincoln, because that's the model that you used from the biblical time until, what do people really know of democracy? You go, you talk to the king, you talk to the emperor. The emperor has the last word. And so that's the model. You go to Lincoln, and he'll tell Grant what to do.
And they said, amazingly, get an audience immediately, go into the White House. And
although, I mentioned earlier this book by Jonathan Sarna, he co-authored with another name I forget, about Lincoln and the Jews.
Yeah.
And we think of running into the president as a rare, limited opportunity.
Not most days.
It was not.
Yeah.
He just had to hang out for a while.
Yeah.
He walked. It was almost like a visit to the doctor. The doctor would walk into the lobby, say, "Okay, you're next."
Yeah, that's right.
And
he immediately overturns the order and sends Grant a rather terse note. And Grant very quickly accedes to that.
Yeah. Again, it's one of these situations where I think people just didn't think.
Yeah.
In the same way that somebody might say to Jew somebody down, right, in terms of negotiating a price.
Yeah.
Right? And then they look up and they see that there's somebody Jewish there. And I think, maybe I shouldn't have said that. Not because there's somebody Jewish here, but now I'm realizing that's really not a good thing to say.
Right.
I think Grant didn't think about it.
Mm-hmm.
He's a general. He's commanding the forces of the Union Army. Religious sensitivity was probably not very high on his radar.
Yeah.
But, when somebody says, that may not be the best thing to do, he changes. First of all, he obeys the commander in chief.
Yes.
But then seems to repent for the rest of his public life.
Yes, he does. And I think that's the fascinating part of the story, is that he called it the stain on his record, which it clearly was. And people tried to use it in the campaign of 1868 against him, largely unsuccessfully, as most of the reporting of the Jewish vote was pro-Republican, as it typically was. But he then goes on to employ a good number of people from the Jewish community in his administration, apparently as much or more than all of the previous administrations combined.
Yeah, although that's a pretty low bar.
It's a low bar. But even more significantly, I think, is his intervention in some humanitarian crises in Russia and Romania in particular, where, again, his advisors are telling him, don't do this because they'll bring up the stain of General Order Number 11. And he is not as concerned about his reputation as he is concerned about the people who are suffering in those countries. So I think that's an extraordinary story of kind of redemption in a lot of ways.
It is. You know, and the skeptic in me might say, well, you know, the involvement in European affairs might also have been sort of the precursor to American global interests. He's a general at heart. And, you know, so he's thinking strategically, or I would hope he would. But nonetheless, I think you're right. And even though the bar of Jewish nominations is pretty low before him, he still has a very solid record for the next 60, 70 years in terms of Jewish appointments. You know, you really won't see numbers. You know, I mean, Woodrow Wilson takes so much heat for putting Brandeis on the Supreme Court. First Jew on the Supreme Court, and Woodrow Wilson takes a lot of heat for that. So, you know, I think Grant's record is a positive one for years to come in that regard.
Yeah. So you brought up some cases, and there's kind of a popularly known one about the 1880s in New Jersey, what they call the free thinking movement. And we've got this guy, Charles B. Reynolds, who's actually arrested for blasphemy. I'm sure you're familiar with this case. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Not really. I'm not familiar with the details of that case. I have to admit that because I'm not an attorney and I'm not law school trained, I've had the luxury of focusing on Supreme Court litigation for most of my academic career. And I've only delved into state cases when it was necessary. but because there are 50 states, that seemed like a whole can of worms I didn't want to get into. There's one Supreme Court that makes it a little easier. But blasphemy is, you know, the earliest charge of blasphemy that I'm aware of is in the early 1800s. For legal case. And it continues, from what I know, into the 1960s. Leonard Levy has a real, just a doorstop of a book called Blasphemy, where he looks at this issue historically. And from my understanding of that case in the 1960s, it had to do with a person being stopped on the highway by a state trooper for ostensibly for speeding or some other moving violation, and then indicating to the officer what he thought of being pulled over, that it might have included some choice words. And so it was sort of an add-on, of, you know, value added to the speeding ticket or whatever. But it was much more common in the 1800s for that to be a standalone offense. And, you know, there's a real problem with blasphemy, and that is no one in the United States has ever been charged with any kind of violation for saying that the Buddha is a fat pig. Right?
Right.
Because while Buddhists would be offended by that, Buddhists don't have a whole lot of political power in this country, certainly not in the 1800s. So blasphemy, by definition, is a state endorsement of a religious position. And that becomes less possible into the mid 1900s. I do remember a blasphemy charge being leveled when I was younger. But it was mostly, it had to do with someone using profanity in a public space, like a park. And so it was I'm reminded of the signs they put up in Virginia Beach along Atlantic Boulevard that have the, you know, the international, you know, no symbol. And then like all the, you know, pound sign, question mark, exclamation point, ampersand, to suggest that you should watch your language while you're cruising. I think that was the sort of spirit of that blasphemy charge.
Seems like they're a little embarrassed by the quarters, even though he's convicted, actually. Reynolds is convicted. But they give him a tiny fine, apparently, that even his lawyer pays instead of the defendant.
Sure.
And I think there's only one major case of this that pops up after Reynolds. So it's not a... I think there's maybe a little bit of a turning by the end of the 19th century that even the states are going to get out of this business of trying to litigate any kind of blasphemy charge.
Well, something we see by the 1890s and come to full flower around the time of World War I is the notion of protected free speech. Whether you could be an anarchist during World War I, that's a federal problem. But ultimately, the Supreme Court and the various state courts in different ways, different times, will recognize a person's right to speak freely. And what's interesting to me is how important the notion of free speech becomes in terms of religious liberty, because the main body of litigation involving religious liberty comes in the 1940s, starting in the 1940s, involving Jehovah's Witnesses. And their arguments are singularly successful when they use free speech, either by itself or as an add-on to religious liberty. When they use only religious liberty arguments, they are unsuccessful. I think it has to do with a court already aware of and supportive of the notion of free speech because of the changes that occurred in the first part of the 20th century, but also with a sort of Protestant privileging of speech over acts. And so free speech makes sense, but being an unusual religious person doesn't. So whether it's Jehovah's Witnesses or, you know, Seventh-day Adventists or, you know, anybody who wants to do something different, that's strange. And the court really can't get their hands around it. But a perfect example is the Pledge of Allegiance case. Right? 1940, it's litigated as a religious issue, and the Jehovah's Witnesses lose. In 1943, it's litigated as a free speech issue, and the Jehovah's Witnesses win. And a lot of their colportage cases, you know, preaching on street corners or door-to-door, are successful because they're able to litigate them as free speech and not as religious liberty.
That's fascinating. So I think it's fair to say that while there's kind of an evolution of religious freedom in this country, there's still some vestiges of establishment that we're haunted by.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it isn't until the 1960s when the court recognizes that in order to have religious liberty, you have to be able to do more than think. Right? The model is set up in the late 1870s, in the case involving the Mormons, where they're basically told, look, you want to believe in plural marriage? Help yourself. Just don't do it. Right? But by the 1960s, the court is saying, look, you know, that's not enough. Religions require behavior. So in the case at hand, Sherbert versus Verner, it had to do with a Seventh-day Adventist woman who refused work on Saturday because it was her Sabbath. And she was denied unemployment. She wasn't seeking her job back, but she was denied unemployment compensation. And so she was suing the state of South Carolina for the unemployment compensation. And the state had said, you could have worked on Saturday. You chose not to work on Saturday. You don't get unemployment. Her argument was, I can't work on Saturday. That's a violation of my religious practices. So it wasn't just, you know, you can believe Saturday is your Sabbath, but you still have to work on it. The court said, no, there are behaviors that necessarily come along with actions. And it's interesting that that step is not made on the court level until there are both Jews and Catholics on the court. Not that Protestants would never come up with that, but that you now have a diversity of thinking about religion. I think we would have a greater diversity of understanding religion if there were other religions on the court. You could expand it to 50 and have one of each, right, whatever they are, and even then you'd be limited. But, you know, if you had a Native American on the court, you would not have 200 years of Native Americans always losing on religious liberty grounds at the Supreme Court level. Always. They have not won a to my knowledge, they have not won a religious liberty case, particularly one involving land claims and land use claims, through the 20th century, and were helped really only by the passage of the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, which gave religious rights back to religious organizations for their land use, which is churches, but also Native Americans, and also institutionalized persons, people in prison who would have religious rights. But if you had a Native American on the court, that it wouldn't have taken so long. And, you know, there's never been someone who's not a Jew or a Protestant or a Catholic on the court. They may be more involved in that identity than others. Some are just not particularly Jewish or not particularly Catholic. But I still think that you bring to your experiences your background, and the expansion of religious liberty has depended on moving away from just the notion of what you believe.
So as we wrap up here, and I wish we could talk about this for hours because you are a wealth of knowledge here, and I'm so excited to have you with us. But what do you see as the most pressing concerns in regards to religious freedom in this country today, and maybe even around the world, but especially in America?
Sure. Well, I'm not trained internationally, but you know, I read the newspaper. And I think probably the most profound argument I've read related to this is by a guy named Benjamin Barber, who wrote a piece in The Atlantic in the 1990s, I think, and expanded it into a book that came out before 9/11, but the title makes everyone think 9/11. It was the title of the book, and I think the article was also Jihad versus McWorld. And his argument was not about Islam. It was about what he called tribalism versus globalism, which can be the case anywhere. And we see it in the United States, just not in as violent a form usually as we see it elsewhere in the world. And that is a conflict, not the clash of cultures conflict of Humphrey and the Christians versus the Muslims kind of garbage, but a worldview conflict between people who feel comfortable anywhere in the world versus people who don't want the world intruding on their life. And those are the tribalists versus the globalists. There are problems with both worldviews, obviously, but that seems to me to be the problem that's beyond our shores, that appears in a lesser degree on our shores. The problem, I think, here in the United States is the battle between traditional religious institutions and a growing number of people who feel absolutely no connection to religious institutions, whether they consider themselves spiritual but not religious, or just don't think about it at all. And we sort of have to wonder, can you preserve rights for one group of people just because they belong to St. Luke's or Rhode of Sholem or, you know, Peter and Paul Catholic Church, or whatever it is. But, you know, some guy who's just, you know, in tune with the world doesn't have the same rights. And I illustrate this, my favorite group, the Pastafarians. I don't know if you're familiar with the Pastafarians, but the Church of the Fly Spaghetti Monster was created as a response to Kansas removing the teaching of evolution from its curriculum. And a graduate student in biology, I think, wrote saying, well, look, if you can have any world creating myth, then here's one. Now, it has become a movement, and people dedicated to the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, Pastafarians, insist some on being permitted to wear a colander on their head in official photographs. Why should they not be, right? If I can wear a kippah in my driver's license photo, why can't a pastafarian wear a colander on his head? Okay. But then the question is, why can't some other guy just wear a baseball cap, right? What gives me more right? Presumably it's that, you know, I'm required because God said so, or the Flying Spaghetti Monster said so. The truth of it is, by the way, the yarmulke is not required. It's a habit over centuries that's taken on the weight of requirement, but it's not required. A point the Supreme Court missed, by the way, in a case involving a yarmulke. But what gives, so we pay deference to that, that God has told someone to do something, which is nice, but it's kind of hypocritical, right? Why doesn't the guy want to wear a baseball cap? Now, I understand face covering. It's interesting to me that in the last couple of years, the anxiety about veils in this country is, and the world, I think, has disappeared as everybody is wearing a face mask.
Yeah.
Now we're not anxious. We kind of prefer if somebody's wearing something covering their face.
Still a little anxious in France and Canada, apparently. But,
well, they are. They are. That is a whole other kind of thing.
Yeah.
We'll reserve for another hour.
That's right.
But you know, I think this there's a real power struggle between those who want to retain religion as it's traditionally understood. In this country, that means mostly in terms of Jewish and Christian patterns versus people who have just decided that it doesn't make sense for them.
Yeah. This has been an amazing way to end our first six episodes on these topics of religious freedom. It will certainly not be the last word, and we'll be returning to a lot of these. And so I'm sure we'll be talking to you again soon. But thank you so much. It was an extraordinary hour that you spent with us. Take care, and thank you, everybody, for listening.
This program was supported by a grant from Virginia Humanities. Virginia Humanities connects people and ideas to explore the human experience and inspire cultural engagement. As the State Humanities Council, Virginia Humanities reaches millions in its estimated annual audience through festivals, grants, fellowships, digital initiatives, teacher institutes, radio programs, podcasts, apprenticeships, and school programs. Headquartered at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia, Humanities works to serve Virginians in every corner of the Commonwealth. To learn more, visit virginiahumanities.org. To learn more about St. Luke's Historic Church and Museum, please visit stlukesmuseum.org.